Hey yo, what is a cipher?
This is how Jimi Hendrix blew it.
Yeah. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 232, A Conversation with Evidence. Evidence first became known to most hip-hop fans as a member of Dilated Peoples. Alongside Raka Ira Science and the virtuosic DJ Babu, the group were beloved champions of hip-hop's underground in the early 2000s. After a number of successful Dilated projects, Evidence decided to go solo in 2007 with The Weatherman. Since then, he's continued to release music on his own, with the group, and even with his longtime friend, the producer Alchemist, as the Step Brothers. Evidence's latest release, which came out just days before this conversation, is Weather or Not. If you like this show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Every new patron helps bring Josh a little closer to commissioning a portrait from Scott Kahn. Also, we know some of you want shirts and other stuff, so please go to merch.thecyphershow.com and get yourself a mug or something. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's James Dean's biggest fan, Evidence. Evidence, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I hear you worked with Kanye West once. How was that?
Let's not go there. You motherfucker. What a great way to start.
Rockefeller, how are you?
If you're interviewing someone in 2018, it's good to know about stuff they did other than their 2004 work with Kanye. Evidence had just been explaining off mic that an unprepared interviewer earlier that day began with, "What have you been up to since?"
I actually did want to ask about something in the past, which was, were you in the audience or was there an audience for the General Hospital reunion special in 93?
My mother went to that.
Evidence's mother, the late actress Jonna Taylor, was on General Hospital from 1963 to 65 playing Angie Costello. She came back in 1993 for the show's 30th anniversary special.
I didn't go to that. My mom didn't want me to see a lot of her acting stuff. She wasn't all the way proud of it. And Angie the Waitress was a prominent role on General Hospital. I've never watched it, but people who told me that's like a reoccurring character, and if that was you, that was a big deal, you know, because to get that part, I'm not sure how General Hospital worked, but I know how TV shows work, period. So I know reoccurring characters come back as different people and it's supposed to just keep flying as normal, you know? So I'm sure she had a role for a while as that. Didn't go with her to that. My mother was really adamant about raising me and just wanted to be home. And so she made a big decision to cut off whatever success she had built up to be a parent, which is now that I'm one, something I'm really understanding on another level, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of the things about growing up in LA that I got from reading about you, listening to interviews with you, that is different than lots of places is the proximity to the children of famous people. You knew, obviously, Quincy Jones's kid was your neighbor.
That was later, but yeah.
But
before that,
Barry Gordy's kid, James Caan's kid.
That was earlier, yep.
Who else? One of your...
Jackson Brown's
kid was, Ethan. And I think still is, one of your best friends.
Correct.
What does that put in you
went
about
to school with
celebrity?
Nicole Richie and all this stuff. And it was normal. It was normal. Well, but to put it in context, so my parents were together. And we lived in the north side of Santa Monica, which was like now probably the nicest place you can live in Santa Monica. And then it was too, but we were on 11th Street, and 11th Street was like the lower section of the nice place. And mainly because all the houses were being rented. There wasn't anybody owning on those streets. So grew up there on like this suburban, like real utopian block. And then my parents got divorced at 4. My dad left at 4 shortly after. We moved to south side of Santa Monica, which was completely different, Dogtown, you know what I mean? And then from there, moved to north side of Venice. So how it worked was basically my mother finagled it with the people who took over the house and after us, to keep that address so I could still go to the north side of Santa Monica schools. And that meant that I had a lot of friends who were sons or daughters of famous people, because this is the area that a lot of their kids are going. And beyond that, networking with kids in Beverly Hills and Century City and graffiti artists and this and that. And you found out that a lot of people have famous parents. So you got you get desensitized to that really early, because when you're young, everything is just normal. It's just what it is. So if you grow up next to famous people, that's just all you really know, you know? And so it was like the Bronx Tale thing. I had two educations.
You would always say that the working man was a sucker, and I was going to the best school in the world, the University of Belmont Avenue. And then I was getting two educations, one from the street and one from school. That way, I'd be twice as smart as everybody.
So, you know, I got on the bus and lived in the more of the hood, and my mother drove me to a good school, and then I took the bus back home every day. And I got to live two lives almost. And the funniest part is at that time, all the rich kids don't want to be rich. So they all want to come to my house anyway, you know, and then just slum it in Venice with me and go see QT3 and whatnot. So we can get to that in a minute. But yeah, it's funny.
One of your first rapping appearances is with Berry Gordy's kid, with Threadfoo.
He's the first citizen. Evidence is in. I stay away from medicine. Crooked ass friends. Some can't hear my curses. Kendall, please reverse my curses. I'll control this verse like my cursor on word perfect.
I believe that's some of the earlier stuff
that
came out.
Yeah, that's like 97, I think.
The freshest.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I guess that's pre-Dilated Peoples.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I had a few things come out. The ruggedness.
Yo, my rhymes are always up to par with the chorus. The chop rappers down like trees in the rainforest. If hip-hop was baseball, I'd win the Cy Young for throwing raps harder than pitchers by Nolan Ryan.
Dilated Peoples song came out on the Bomb compilation out of San Francisco. And the song called The Ruggedness, maybe 94, 95. And we had one song on Immortal Records' Next Chapter compilation as Dilated Peoples that came out in 94.
Yo, first aid is made for those who needed evidence. Becoming ill, never defeating the purpose. But I propose my flows go off the deep end. Living every day of the week like a weekend. That's just my lifestyle. I cut like a knife.
But those are rare sightings. You know what I mean? So Redfoo is Berry Gordy's son. You probably know him as the big guy with the afro
with the hair.
Shake that.
Yeah, but he was like the early best producer around my crew. He had Cubase and he had a reel to reel and he had real shit. Like he could make in a real studio and he knew compression and shit before most people did. So doing a demo at his name was Kendall at the time. Mm-hmm. At Kendall's house was legit. You know what I mean? And that's the place I wanted to be.
Just to circle back for a second.
Yeah, we're jumping over.
Yeah. But being around, fame.
So I moved next to QT3 when I moved to Venice.
Oh, okay.
So that's how this all happened. That's right. How my introduction to rap, everything happened.
QT3 is Quincy Delight Jones III, the son of legendary producer Quincy Jones and Swedish model Ulla Anderson. While he began his career in the early 1990s as a rap producer, he later moved on to making hip-hop documentaries, including The Carter about Lil Wayne and the extremely successful Beef series.
Did you know what a producer was before you met him?
No, I had no idea. No. And the funniest part is I lived next door and the music would be on and it would go loud and it would start and then it would stop. And it would play loud for like 15 seconds and stop again. And I was wondering why you keep stopping the music. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't understand the concept, but really what he was probably doing was like programming a beat, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or something like that. And he was making a track. So you got to understand, I'm 14 or 13 and this guy's he's probably 20 something and he's got long dreadlocks and, you know, driving a Jeep Cherokee and he's always got a hot chick in the front. And to me, this guy, I was like, who the hell is this guy and what is he doing back there? He got pit bulls. And then I finally got the nerve one day to walk up to him and ask him. And he said, I'm QT3. I'm a rap producer. So he's come back to my garage. Check out what I'm doing. And I did. And that's how I learned how rap got made. I didn't understand it until that point.
Right. And how do you go from there to going on tour with Cypress Hill and all that kind of stuff that came like not that long afterwards?
So what happened was so QT3 was the guy. He was the guy. You got to understand, there's way before Pro Tools, way before the Common Studio, anything like that. You know, having somebody who could produce you and record you was a big deal. And so, nonetheless, Quincy Jones' son. So my house became the place. Will 1X, who's Will I Am, you know, that was one of my first demos I did. He would come over. Ahmad, DJ Am, Alchemist, Scott Kahn, and a handful of others all come over my house in the hopes of going over to QT3.
A quick rundown of the people Evidence is naming here. Will One X was a member of the terribly named Atban Clan. It stood for A Tribe Beyond a Nation. That group, with Will renamed Will I Am, would eventually morph into the Black Eyed Peas. Adam DJ AM Goldstein was an incredibly influential DJ who sadly died of a drug overdose in 2009. The Alchemist is, of course, a producer who worked with pretty much everyone and is also Eminem's tour DJ. Scott Kahn was the Alchemist groupmate in the early 90s duo The Hooligans. They recorded a single and a never-released album with Tommy Boy. Kahn, who is the son of actor James Kahn, would later move to acting and star in the revamped Hawaii Five-O.
And jump out my window, smoke some weed, whatever. We could do that over there. And so I wanted to work with QT3, but when I brought Alchemist and Scott Kahn over, I think QT3 saw something. And he was like, all right, Evidence. You know what I mean? I'll help you. You're my neighbor, but this is a gold mine right here. So he kind of just took all his focus off anything I had going on. But not that he was ever interested, but just he showed me like, yo, these two kids you brought over, I'm going to work with them. And so he made the Hooligans' first demo. They were called Lower Level. And before the Hooligans, you know, and I think he tried to sign them and it didn't work. And then somewhere along the line, they met B-Real, Buzztone Management, and they decided to make a choice to go with B-Real instead of QT3. That's how it all started, you know? And then I think Scott and Alan, you know, Alchemist, well, he was Mudfoot at the time. And they always wanted to bring me along because they knew I kind of birthed the chance for them to have a demo, you know? And so when they were on tour of Cypress Hill, they found a way for me to come, you know, and stuff like that. So they were including me a lot in their early things and letting me see it, even though I wasn't actively participating in the Hooligans.
And how do you convince your mom at 14 to say, oh, I'm going on tour with Cypress Hill?
It's so crazy. It's really like the Almost Famous shit. You know, you kind of finagle it for, I'm going to go for a day. I'll be back. And then, mom, we're going to San Francisco. Santa Cruz is the next stop. And you just work it out to where you end up missing a week of tour, a week of school because you just, but going back, thinking about it, my mom probably saw a lot of shit and she was probably like, you know what? Let him just do what he's going to do. Because she could see I was happy.
Yeah. Just as a complete tangent, where is Scott Kahn's memoir, by the way? That guy seems to have had just a wild 14 different lives.
I think so. He did a photo book that was really impressive. You ever see that?
No.
He's a photographer as well. Yeah. I mean, big success to Scott Kahn. You know, and the funny part is right before Hawaii Five-O, I hope I don't put his business on blast, but it's really inspiring because he was going through a little lull. You know what I mean? And he had taken on some properties and he was talking to me and Alchemist like, yo, if I don't get a gig soon, shit's going to get real. And then, you know, he just stayed on his craft, hustling hard, and then this landed. It always goes to show if you do something because you love it, you will be rewarded. It just doesn't always happen in the time you expect it to.
And growing up, you spent summers actually just over the bridge from here, right, in Brooklyn.
Yeah, in Brooklyn. My father and my mother are both from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. My father was from the Bensonhurst, Coney Island area, and my mother was from Brownsville, but it was more a Russian neighborhood when she was growing up, you know? So yeah, my father always took me to see my cousins and my grandparents on his side every summer. I'd come to Brooklyn. But the funniest part is I would only go to Coney Island, you know, and I didn't understand this. They don't leave Coney Island. You know, their whole world is based on like a 5-block radius.
It's still like that, by the way.
Yeah. And so I thought that's what New York was. I never went to Manhattan. I never did anything. I thought I would come back to California and be like, oh man, New York is crazy, man. You know, it's like the Ferris wheels and there's a beach. And you know, I was totally, and then as I got older, I would tell people, yeah, and they're to Coney Island. And everybody goes, oh, that's way the fuck out. Wow, that's far out. That's the main thing everyone said. So I realized later I didn't really see New York for shit. But I did see a beautiful and very interesting section of it.
Yeah. How old were you when you were going there?
From 6 till like 15.
Okay.
Yeah, or 14.
In the early stages of that, before you discovered your neighbor and rap coming from there, were you aware of rap as a thing associated with New York City?
Yeah, for sure. But that was Run DMC and that was like untouchable shit. I wasn't ever considering participating in that. That was just like mega big shit to me. You know what I mean? So yeah, that's like asking if I thought I was going to do what Bon Jovi did, or I don't know. It was just big to me. That's all it was. And big music things. I never considered being a part of.
Right. And where did graffiti start to creep in?
I was a really good baseball player. I think that's probably the one thing I did best in life. I just had this curveball, man, and nobody could hit it. And it became a drug to me because anytime I threw the ball straight, they would whack it. But as soon as I threw this curve, I mean, they'd bail out and then it would break and hit strike. I was kidding. Michael Jackson in our league. And I mean, this kid would hit homers every, he was just too big for the league. People didn't even believe he was fucking the right age. You know what I mean? And he was just the most deadly guy. And I started pitching against him and I'd throw this curveball and he would just not know what the fuck to do, you know? And So it became this drug that I couldn't throw anything else, but that really was hurting my arm bad, especially at a young age when you're not developed. Throwing a curve, throwing a ball overhand is not natural. Throwing under is, you know, that's a natural motion. So just throwing a ball is not natural, but nevertheless, snapping it off. And what happened was, is I was the best at pitching. But then when we got to high school, it became the major league distance. So I used to pitch 45 feet from pitcher's mound to home plate. Mm. Now it became 60 feet. And the base pass became 90 feet. And I still wasn't physically growing enough. So as soon as I had big expectations on me, scouts watching and the whole shit. And I got to that next level up high school and started throwing that curve. And it was so far away that people were just taken off on it. So now I don't got a fastball and I don't got a curve. I'm getting whacked. It's fucking up my confidence and my well-being because I'm known for being good at something. So around then I found weed. Found graffiti, started taking acid, going to Venice Beach. You know what I mean? I was just like, I had to move into something creative because this wasn't going to work. And I'll never forget it. I was piecing on a wall in Venice, and just by the weirdest grace of God, I don't know how it happened, my baseball coach pulled up. He saw some people doing graffiti and he was like smoking a joint doing, and he was just like, what the fuck happened to my all-star pitcher, man? You know what I mean? And that's just what it was. I never looked back. I could never, my arm would hurt so bad. I couldn't write in class. It was hell, not for me.
I always like asking people what they wrote when they started out. What were some things you used to write?
I wrote Vane, V-A-N-E. There was a graffiti artist named Vision from West Coast Artists. He was like my hero kind of. And he gave me that name, V-A-N-E, not because I was a vain person, because he was like, these letters are fire. He's like, a V-A-N-E, he's like, that's perfect.
Seems to be a way a lot of people get their names, not because the word, they have any association with the word other than the letters are cool.
Yeah, that's all it was. And I did that and then graduated to AWR and became MSK. And then graffiti got a little more serious for me. And then getting arrested was no. So I was like, this is not it. And then music came. So I was like, it was perfect. It was a perfect transition. It's all under the hip hop umbrella anyway.
You know, you're talking about Alan and Scott a minute ago. How did you first meet Alchemist? Do you remember?
Yeah, I knew Scott Kahn from graffiti because he used to tag also. And Alchemist used to tag Divine, I think. And there was a crew they had and I know who they were. And there was a show at the Troubadour one night, I believe, or something like that. And there was a open mic and Alchemist always reminds me. I don't remember it, but he was with Scott Kahn and I knew Scott. And apparently I just walked up to the front door where they were at. And I just went, where's the open mic at? And so he was like, who's this guy searching for a microphone? Cause not everyone was rapping then. So yeah, he said that was his first impression of me. And then we became really tight after that. We started smoking weed together, buying weed together. He was selling baseball cards. We did that little innocent shit. But one thing about Alchemist was he was like nobody else hanging out. Like he was a really crafty, likable young guy, the type where if he didn't like you, something was wrong with you. You know, it's like Babu or a couple other people I know, you know, and as life's gone, Alchemist become a cynical, stony asshole. But back then he was like this really like lighthearted dude. You just couldn't not like Alchemist. It was impossible.
Speaking of music, when you're maybe seven, a song comes out that really grabs you and orients you in rap. Jam on it.
Yeah, and Paul Hardcastle, 19. We are the jam on blue, and jamming on it is how we do the do. We'll funk you up until you boogie down, so come on, people, check out. In World War II, the average age of the combat soldier was 26. In Vietnam, he was 19. 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 19. It was like an electronic record, but this was another song everyone was dancing to.
Looking back, have you ever figured out what it was about that record that grabbed you?
It's the bass line. And I think about it. Boom, 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 boom. That's just still that shit to me, man. Boom, 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 boom. I had never heard anything like that. And then you got to understand, it's coupled with seeing some guy doing the illest moves at the same time. You know, it was just like...
It would be on Venice Beach.
It was Santa Monica Pier.
Santa Monica Pier.
Yeah, that was still the hood back then. And so I seen that. And then obviously Venice Beach, everyone was getting busy. But that night at the pier, when I heard that song and I made my mom, what is this? And I think she asked somebody, found out what it was and bought me the tape, you know, and I never made it to fucking song two. I have that whole album till this day. I've never played another song off of it. It was the most special record to me. Years later, fucking Knots, man, flipped Jam on it for the game. You got it. This song wasn't a big record or anything, but you got to hear the way he flipped it. That's my Knots is one of the fucking greatest, man. Yeah.
Talking about that transition from middle school to high school, right? Where baseball ends, music begins.
Yep.
You have that tune A Moment in Time where you talk about it and you talk about ninth grade being this very hard year where you were looking back at middle school. And at 14, you're like, man, I was the shit in middle school.
I missed the whole ninth grade ditching class, getting no ass, trying to get back to the past.
Are you still like a nostalgic, reflective person?
Yes and no, because not like when it comes to my music or my career, I try to forget about a lot of things I've done and only focus on forward. Like I'm not a guy who like harps on his discography. So like for music, personally, no. But for other things in life, very much so. It was a rough time because you go from being really popular to looking at this big fucking world that you can't, yeah, small fish in a big pond, you know, and that uncertainty is really crazy. I dreaded my hair that year because, you know, my hair gets curly and I had just kind of let it go. And then I've had someone twist it up. And I remember I came to school with dreads, people looking at me fucking crazy. Someone had fronted me an ounce of weed and I smoked it and I tried to sell it, but I didn't. And I ended up smoking it. And then I was dodging them throughout school, not going to classes. And it was just a fucked up year, man. It was really probably the hardest year of my life.
How did skating come into things? You mentioned Dogtown and you have that song where you say, you know, half B-boy, half Z-boy.
Yes.
Half B-boy, half Z-boy. The street lights.
The Zephyr Competition Team, or Z-Boys, was a group of skateboarders in the mid-1970s from Santa Monica and Venice. The moves they invented became the basis for skateboarding today.
I think just growing up in Venice, knowing how to kickflip is like a prerequisite. You know what I mean? It's just everyone kind of knows how to do that, you know? Yeah. Skating was fun for me, but it was a phase. You know, when I got out of skating, I never looked back like, damn, you know what I mean? That was just something I did for a while that I had fun doing.
I was looking at, I think this was your first video with Dilated for Third Degree. Was that the first one you shot?
Yep.
My name is Evidence, and my mic can strike anywhere match. In fact, after this track, we'll have you stuck like tax. It's the 1, 2, 3 MCs. Now it's all turned to burn. It plays for always. No, it's the 1, 2, 3.
And you're writing in that. You're tagging in that.
Yeah, the Dilated People's Tag.
Yeah, maybe your very first thing where people are going to see you and see your music. Why was it important for you to be writing in that?
That thing was Jason Gowatch had a Super 8 camera and he was just following us around downtown LA for the day. So
I'm out here wildin'.
Jason Goldwatch went on to direct videos for Jay Electronica, Action Bronson, Kid Cudi, and countless other artists, as well as a number of documentaries. He's also the co-founder of the creative studio Decon.
Catching that tag was probably, I had a marker on me, it was probably something that I was actually doing. You know, it wasn't like, you film in, here I go. He's probably just filming me.
Wow.
Yeah, but I was just young.
Yeah, it's a great video, actually. I really like see you guys enthusiastic.
I love it.
Moving on.
I still love that video.
Nice. So Babu comes in about a year into you being, were you a duo at that point?
We were a duo. I didn't care to have a DJ. Wasn't a thing, like a big thing on my mind, but Rocket was really adamant about it. Mm-hmm. We were just using different DJs when we would do shows. Work the Angles is actually DJ Revolution. It's not Babu, you know. So he cut on Triple Optics, which is, we did two maxi singles, we called them, or whatever. They were vinyls, but the first one we came out was Third Degree, Confidence, and Global Dynamics. And none of those records had scratches on them. And then the second 12-inch, which was really scratch heavy, was Work the Angles, Main Event, and Triple Optics. And Triple Optics was the first time Babu scratched.
Triple Optics.
A lot of people thought he did the Work the Angles cuts because he can do them so good live, you know, but that was Revolution. So he joined the group shortly after.
I assume he was a virtuoso when he joined you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that change the dynamic of the group?
There was a lot of pluses and a few negatives. Having three people is a weird dynamic because there's always an odd man out, you know? And so, you know, things get, you start voting and there's always going to be a guy and it's rarely unanimous or whatever. So the bad thing was, is it let that happen if me and Rocka wanted to outvote him, if him and Rocka wanted to outvote me. That was the worst part about it to me. And it took a while for us to like kind of treat Babu as a fair member, because we were kind of like, is this guy going to stay with us? You know what I mean?
I was going to ask, how long was he the new guy?
For a while.
Is he still?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. It was inspiring. It was inspiring. But it was also like having a new stranger around a little bit. So yeah, maybe made us act a little different, or maybe showed out a little bit for a while. I don't know. I was young. So yeah, probably looking back from like a psychiatrist's perspective. Yeah, it probably made me not me as much as it would be if it was just two people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've talked about that even just in terms of rapping, that you were guarded as an artist when you began rapping.
Yeah.
I was guarded as an artist from the first day I started. I lowered my voice deep and tried to rap hardest.
You understand, I was hanging out with everybody older. So I was a 15-year-old hanging out with 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds. That's a huge difference when you're a teenager. Now it doesn't matter if I'm 35 and he's 40 or 39. That doesn't matter.
Right.
At that time, I can't drive. I have a curfew. You know what I mean? These guys are free to do what they want. You know what I mean? I'm just inexperienced in everything. So, and I said it on this album, you know, coming up quick without a pop in the mix. I ain't talking about sound. My pops and I had a split.
I was coming up quick without a pop in the mix. And I ain't talking about sound. My pops and I had a split. Self-taught to be a man. I learned how to behave. Cut my teeth at Venice Beach and had a few close
shades.
So
once again, looking back at it, at that time, my dad was with a girl I didn't really like that much. And we had a fight over it, and it ended up being a few years, you know. And I was probably using a lot of these people as father figures or big brothers, you know? And so I never wanted to be better than any of them. I had no desire to be the best. I just wanted to be accepted, you know? And because I, as a young kid would, you know what I mean? And so what that meant was I was trying to be fucking doper, and I was trying to go down, and I would press the records and I would slow them down a little bit after it was done. Like literally.
To physically lower your voice.
Yes. Wow. You know what I'm saying? If you listen to Main Event, the song, like if you put it on +2.5, that's probably where it actually is.
Alias evidence intensify when live. I understand pace. I understand stride. The only thing worse than lose your title, have it stolen. I treat beats like video games that I'm controlling. Alias evidence intensify when live. I understand pace. I understand stride. The only thing worse than lose your title, have it stolen. I treat beats like video games that I'm controlling.
You know what I mean? Like, so I was like, because we print from DAT, so I would just slow the DAT machine down. You know what I mean? And I was just doing a lot of overcompensating for not being comfortable with who I was.
Yeah, and Rocka, like you said, was one of the people that was a little older than you.
Yeah.
Still is, I guess, but it mattered more.
Yeah.
When, you know, like you said, you're 15, he's 18 or 19.
Yeah.
You have years in the making, right? In that song, you talk about this period, 90 to 94, where you are growing, you're finding your style, you're finding who you are as a writer.
My first verse from 90 to 94, mostly peeping cat styles out and hitting the floor a little bit. In 91, that's when we got down. Different sides of town, the bus, I made rounds. I was involved in graffiti heavily. My peoples were self-taught with Freck R.I.P. At night I heard beats next door by QD3. Inspiration Destin Evie, producer MC. Now at this point, my face wasn't no...
Who were sort of important voices to you during that period?
Self was a graffiti artist named Fremont. Originally wrote Reek, W-R-E-A-K from A-W-R, and then became Self, then became Thesis 3, then became Dr. Israel. I watched him, he went crazy, you know what I mean? And I seen it all happen. But this guy, a lot of people ended up biting his style and didn't give him credit for it. Tao was one of my just really close friends, Tao Waisaki. He became a big DJ at Davis in Northern California, I believe, like an EDM type DJ or something. And he's also good friends with Pasquale Rotella, who does Electric Daisy Carnival. So that was just a good one of my best friends. And Freck was probably my biggest influence. Jeremy Segrist tagged Jade, and his more gangster name was Freck, F-R-E-K. And this guy was like my hero. You know, he was respected. He could fight. And he was like sunny to see for me. You know what I mean? That was the guy who like made it legit for me to go around. So, and he passed away in 93. He lived 20 years, you know? So, rest in peace, Freck. That's who I reference in that song, in that line.
Yeah. It's funny. I was talking to Jim Jones maybe a week or two ago, and we were talking about Special Ed, who he mentioned as a big influence.
One of my biggest.
And I know is one of yours. Tell me about that.
So UMTV Raps was huge to me, you know, because that school got out at 3:00. And UMTV Raps was from 3 to 3:30. So that means I could get out 5 minutes early, hopefully, you know, and ask my teacher or whatever, run home as fast as I could and catch 10 minutes and get two new videos or one new video. You know, that time it was DOC was really, it's funky enough, was like mind blowing to me. And Special Ed, I got it made, man. And that whole album, Youngest in Charge, I don't understand why, but his flow was so clean, man. And I still idolize it to this day. King of the slow flow. You know what I mean? I fly. I wonder why. What's the reason for the treason? Huh? You want to die? I'm high post. Higher than most. Not from France, but I eat French toast. I'm international. I got cash in all ways.
Cash in all ways. Got dollars in my pocket. Because, man, it pays to be smart. I turned my...
Like, yo, he was... And he was kind of biting Rakim now that I listen back. Crazy.
But you don't know that as a kid.
Nah, obviously. Not really. Yeah. So to me, he was just like, wow.
To tie into that, on the very first Dilator record, you have this thing about it's not where you put your words.
That's where you don't.
Yeah.
It's
my motto. I didn't write, but this I quote. It ain't where you put
your words, it's where you don't. End quote. And with this. Yeah, that was, it ain't my words, this I quote. It was John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yeah, he was talking about space and how we're all scared of it. We have the need to da-da-da-da-da-da. We have to fill up space. Space is the most beautiful part. You don't play,
yeah.
But you don't say,
and that's been reflected in your rhyme style a little bit.
I think so. Yeah, and it's been misunderstood and overly understood by those. So it's funny.
Do you think that people think you can't do something else?
Maybe,
Yeah.
But you got to understand too. I grew up the biggest Freestyle Fellowship fan. I grew up the biggest Organized Confusion fan. I mean, I wake up to the mathematics of an erratic rap rejuvenator of rhyme, the soda come automatic poetic. Medical medicine for the cerebellum. I divert them, infer them, insert them, then I repel them, a freak. I mean, I could do it to the fucking T, man. And it's super fast and it's super slow. And it's not about that. It's about me. I always enjoyed the words. So like when, you know, I just said that Pharoah Monch amazingness, right? But I could also say Devin the Dude. Keep the breakfast in bed. I'd rather spend my morning digging through some records instead. But tonight I guess it'd be alright if we can touch bases. Hook up somewhere and exchange some fuck faces. I know your man. And to me, that's just as powerful as wake up to the mathematics of an erratic rap rejuvenator of rhyme that sort of come on. It's just because what he's doing over there is showing how great he is lyrically. What the other guy do is painting this really vivid picture for me that's totally relatable. You know, I can see it. I can relate to it. I can feel it.
Right. And part of the picture is how he's saying it and his accent.
And that too, and everything. Yeah. And so, yeah, that Special Ed, those type of people, EPMD, Parrish Smith, I gravitated towards that a little bit more than I wanted to be a Micah 9 or AC Alone or a Pharoah Monch or a Big Daddy Kane. Yeah. But those were my heroes.
Of course.
Yeah. So yeah. It's just a choice creatively. Yeah. You know what I mean?
In a full circle sense, you got PMD on the slow flow remix.
Get real, you know P, put the B in ball. I did it to death. Back again, you stuck in the store. Come on.
How was that?
It was one of the best times ever, man. I stayed in New York with Alchemist crib. Alchemist was gone for the day. I reached PMD probably through MySpace. He drove to Alchemist crib, came there by himself. I got to record him. I even got to help, I didn't write anything by any means, but I got to say, yo, you know, this line I love, you know, put him in the yoke and snap his neck. To rhyme on a rap, but then proceed to wreck by breaking his mic in half, then put him in the yoke and snap his neck. You know, and he's like, you want me to flip that? I flip it. You know what I mean? I was like, please, you know what I mean? Like, flip that line, please, please, for my verse. I flex a rhyme on the rapper, then proceed to wreck by breaking his mic in half, then put him in the yoke and snap his neck. With 5-0 rolls, they say. So, yeah, it was like, working with PMD was like super full circle for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you got to do stuff with the Beastie Boys.
I did.
As well.
Yeah, a live remix. Good job, so socialized. Open up your ears and clean out your eyes. You learn the love you're in from the surprise. It can be nice to be alive. Which they liked so much, they swapped it out and made it the video version.
Amazing. I want to jump back to Dilated. So between the first record and Expansion Team, you guys went overseas, or at least that's how it seems if you listen to songs like Trade Money that
yeah, we
have this kind of international perspective.
Yo, been to certain places where the term green don't mean shit because money's blue and that's what it takes to pay rent. Trade money.
We'd have to do press. They'd send us over there to do press and like an NME showcase or like a showcase and something, but it was always free. We'd always have to go to Europe for free and do press, and just sit out there and then we come back and try to go back there and then get our paper. But Rocker, once again, was very adamant about going to Europe. He kept saying, when America don't give a fuck, they're going to still care about us. This is how Jimi Hendrix blew up, and trust me, man. And so, yeah, he wanting a DJ and showing me the importance of Europe are the two most important things, or in a group. Those two things really, like, if he didn't show me those, maybe I'd be on something.
So you're at this point in your maybe early 20s going to Europe. What was that like?
It was weird. The first time we went was from Sweden. That was fun, but we only went for a day or two for a festival with Jurassic 5. Grinding it out in London when we were staying at shit hotels and not understanding how everything works, pre-internet, being hella bored, can't find weed, like nothing to fucking do, man. You know what I mean? Like, I remember sitting in Europe a few times like, man, this is fucking literal hell right now. I didn't know what to do with my physical body, you know? It got a lot better as we started figuring it out for sure, you know? But yeah, it was adjustments that had to be made.
Yeah.
We got stuck in Europe for 9/11.
Really?
Yeah, for 2 weeks. Couldn't get home. Airports were shut. We were touring Linkin Park in Germany. Canceled all shows. Couldn't get home. I had my mom trying to fucking get me home every day. It was the closest thing I ever felt. Trapped. And I was free to breathe the air and go wherever I want. Just not in the country I knew, you know?
Yeah. I was going to ask about that. As someone with New York family ties, you have a song where you kind of hint at your connection to New York in the context of 9/11, but it's just kind of a passing thing in the song, which otherwise is a tribute to New York City.
Down in New York City?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So many heroes passed to ground zero. Man, y'all rebounded.
Oh, y'all rebounded down in New York City. Yeah. That song was cool. It was fun to write a song. I got a beat from Jake One and the sample was going down in New York City. So I was like, okay, let's do the backwards thing here. And that made an interesting record. But I did have a perspective on it from being here so many times. Yeah.
I wanted to actually ask about your production, because that's a side of you that I don't think you talk about that much. The first production that I was able to find was 96, 97 stuff for the Swollen Members, stuff for Defari.
Shatterproof. Who would have thought that the edge of the earth is underneath your feet, right where you stand?
6 million's what it cost them to put back together that cat Steve Austin. Now Defari is bionic. Over 6 million tracks with 10 million topics.
I don't know if the last time you listened to any of those records, but when you listen back to them, what do you hear?
Innocence, mistakes, things out of key, out of tune, not knowing any better. I love that about those. You know, that's what I do love about them. It's the same reason I love De La Soul's first album. You can just tell they didn't quite know what they were doing yet. You know what I mean? And that's what's so good about it. You know, Kanye West's first album. You see, you can rap for anything except for Jesus. It's like he was trying to like some of these, he was off beat and stuttering sometimes.
They said you can rap about anything except for Jesus. That means guns, sex, lies, videotape. But if I talk about God, my record won't get played.
Then it made it. That shit, you know, I think Kanye West and I think also De La Soul are obviously incredibly better than they were on their first projects. But that doesn't mean that I don't love their first project the most still.
Yeah.
You know, and so that innocence of placing kick drums in the wrong places because I'm not knowing better, or adolescent chops, you know, it was good. It's got me to where I am now.
Do you hear any consistencies, any through lines in your early work to your production today?
Yeah, the soundscape, being influenced by who I'm influenced, caring about sonics. You know, I can say my old shit banged, for sure. I was never sonically slacking.
Speaking of sonics, you've worked with Eddie Sancho for years.
Engineer Eddie Sancho has been in the studio with many of hip-hop's greatest stars, but is best known for working closely with DJ Premier.
Yeah, he makes worse come to worse. I mean, it's like we go back with him so long, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's why work with a guy for all your stuff, even though most of the time you're literally on the other side of the country.
Well, when we dilated, we used a lot of different engineers. We used Seagal. We used Cutmaster Kurt. We used Troy Staton. We used Manny Mariquin. We used some real Anton Pachansky, some amazing... Didn't Anton do one on here?
Yeah, Anton's been a guest on the show.
147.
Yeah, we work with Anton, you know, and a lot of these people. So the truth of the matter is somebody told me, go to the source. So if you're trying to find out what bass Parliament was using or Bootsy was using, you should go find the guitar that they were playing it with instead of going trying to find a keyboard. Well, maybe Parliament is a bad example, but Bootsy or somebody, you know, you go find... Go find the instrument that they were using. Don't find a keyboard and try to emulate it. Go to the source. So for me, the sound, the God sound of rap that I was magically touched by was Gangstar and anything affiliated with Premier. And coincidentally, this is the engineer who worked with Premier for most of his career. So I realized Premier shaped his own sound. But I do know that Eddie was an integral part of it for a long time. And so I went to the source. I went to Eddie Sancho. And once I started my solo career, I made a decision. I'm just going to use him for all of it. So it's four albums now I've done with him. And it's part of my sound.
As a producer, is there a difference for you to make a beat that is going to be an instrumental that you'll rap on, that maybe you'll try to get someone else to rap on? Where in the process do those decisions get made? Is it in composition? Is it only afterwards?
So I was always taught when you produce, the star is the vocal, you know? So I think there's instrumental producers who are much more elaborate and probably a lot more entertaining to listen to the instrumental by itself than my beats. My beats are set up to make a rapper want to rap and be the star of. So I leave a lot of room on the top for the vocal to sit. I make a lot of choices in my filtering and where the top ends and where the vocals start. And I'm not really interested in listening to my music instrumentally. I think I'm making half of the production for the vocalist to be the star.
And speaking of the vocalist being the star, you produced perhaps Sean Price's single Filthiest Song, Barbecue Sauce.
Man.
But the father do floss, I make your mom suck my dick with barbecue sauce. Brr, brr, motherfucker.
Do you remember how you reacted when you first heard the song, the hook, and the whole thing?
Yeah, well, the hook came last. I didn't hear that right away. So he was in Los Angeles. Alchemist brought him to my studio. It was right when I was making the I Don't Need Love EP with the Beatles stuff. Mm. And Twiz was at my crib. And Sean Price walked in, rest in peace. And with Alchemist, and he was like, this is the beat. I'm using this one for sure. I had already sent it. And where's the microphone? Do this shit. You know, whatever. And he did the first verse, you know, and fuck, man. It was like, sometimes people in the studio, you know, you're not tripping on it. But he was a real performance. Like, when he came out of the booth, we were like, make your mom suck my dick, barbecue sauce. It was just like, who is this guy, man? Fuck you. So effortlessly, too. He, you know, and the best part was, he goes, I think we should do the second verse at Alchemist's house. And Alchemist's mic is better than mine. So if you go back and listen to that song, the second verse is a little more sonic.
Wow.
Because it's cut there. That's Bafashiki. You know, he comes in with that one.
Bafashiki. Full fist knock, and you rock, and you die for leaving. Pop your beanies for rocking the hot bikini. Transgender.
And once again, we were dying. So yeah, first verse at my crib, second verse at Alchemist, and then he sent the hook to Pharaoh. And it came back as that. I was so proud to be a part of that. And the video is so crazy.
Right, yeah, the video is obviously amazing. You were in the studio while Nas's like was being made?
And of course, NAS are the letters that spell
Nas, Nas, Nas. Like life or death. I'm a rapper. My poetry's deep, I never felt.
Man, that's a crazy story. Yeah. I don't know what, we'd have to do the math on what year I was born and what year that came out. But maybe my 22nd, 23rd birthday, I flew to New York. And It was the night of my birthday, and Alchemist, he was like, let's get out of here. And I was like, where are we going? He's like, let's just get out of here. And we got in a cab and we went to D&D, and took me there and took me into Primo's room. We smoking weed and just was fucking being looped over and over and over. And I swear it got better every time it turned around, you know? And I was just like, this could be for Nas, man. You know, I just had the drums for a while, but I got this loop going on. This is crazy. Me and Howard just sitting there. I got on the phone next to, yo, I heard this beef. It's going to be called Nas is Like. And it's this, and trying to explain it to people. You know, and I'm such a young kid, and the superhero with the cape is making the beats in front of me. And it was just so innocent. And I looked up to people so much. I don't understand quite why, because I'm not like that anymore so much, you know? But at that time, like, I really, like, they were posters on my wall. You know, so then you meet these people and they're just, you're in awe of them, being part of being young.
We started off joking about Kanye, and you've talked plenty about Last Call and producing it and some of the stories involved with that.
Yeah.
But my one question about it is, where on earth did you find that Bette Midler record?
Mr. Rockefeller, how are you? Mr. Rockefeller.
My friend Porce. So if you notice, it says additional production Porce. Porce is a friend of mine from Sweden who I grew up with. I mean, he grew up in, you know, in Santa Monica, but he's Swedish, speaks Swedish and everything. He was an amazing graffiti writer, P-O-R-S-E, and don't know what the fuck it means. Good letters once again. And as we got on to getting older, he became a great digger. That was his thing, digging. He made beats, but he was the kind, like, he would find a loop and put a snare to it and a kick, and then that was it. His motivation to see a record through wasn't there like mine, but he had the fucking ear of all time. He was also really broke. So I would pay ludicrous amounts for records that he would dig for me to kind of help my man out. So he would come with a record with dots on song three, dots on the other side, dot four. He'd come play me the record, put it at the right pitch. Or if you put it at 45, listen to this. And I'd be like, yo, how much you want for that record? $300. I know it's a 99-cent record. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I'll give it some point. You know, you right. found it for me. That's part of the homework. Right. So the Bette Midler one was just another beat he had where he had given me a batch of records. And the funniest part is, I don't think he was really tripping on Mr. Rockefeller. I just think he liked the loop at the beginning of the record. Like, this is a good loop. As I started making the beat, I started putting the Mr. Rockefeller part. And yeah, I had it ready just coincidentally when I got the call to work with Kanye. Because how I met him was to work for Dilated Peoples. That was the first time Capitol Records sent us back to the studio.
Oh.
So the Neighborhood Watch album we did was finished without This Way.
And then they said, you need a song with a hot producer.
Yeah, because the record before Worst Come to Worst was getting a lot of spins. We almost went gold. They were like, you need to make something. Black Eyed Peas was kind of blowing up, I think. They were like, I think they were feeling us for the first time in the possibility of being accepted by program directors and getting into like more of a mainstream rotation. So they were like, they said, Scott Storch. So we said, what do you want? And they said, well, how about you work with some producers we suggest? Who are they? Scott Storch came up and Kanye West came up. And we tried to work with Scott Storch and it didn't go through. The beat that he let us rap to, I guess Dre wanted back for something else. And that just got pulled from us. And that was the end of that. And then we thought Kanye was cool. But I was tripping on Kanye because he did The Truth for Beanie Siegel and he did Just to Get By for Blueprint. You know what I mean? Let's not forget that. But to me, he was just a soul sample alchemist type. It really wasn't like to say for us to go work with him wasn't like a compromise to me. I was like, it's just another stranger. I don't know who's like-minded.
Right.
But then when I met him, I seen why they wanted us to work with him. He was a little special, like on some different shit. You know, like I started to catch the wind of, oh, this guy's going to be big type shit. You know, I see why we're just working early. You know, I could feel it. And then he didn't have a car. I was picking him up from the hotel, driving him to the studio, and then the second day, we had him for 1 week to make This Way.
Yeah, Kanye to the... My favorite girl wanna leave me just because I got a girlfriend. My freak girl told me now she a Christian. My white girl wanna move back to Michigan. I'm pulling girls off the bench like a six man. I'm in the club doing...
And second and third day, I had been a little comfortable, so I put in the CD and I said, Jay-Z's making Black Album. Will you play this for him? You're the only person in the world I know who could. You know what I mean? And he was like, you know what? I think I'm going to use that. I think I'm the new Mr. Rockefeller. In my mind, I was just like, you're crazy. You know what I mean? But okay.
Yeah, sure you are, pal.
Sure you are, pal. But he was right, man. And so yeah, Porus is really responsible for making that loop happen. And then the trip about it is the loop didn't clear. So that's when I backed out. I just told him, yo, I'm sorry. And he was like, no, I'm gonna take it. And that's why it says produced by him and me, because he really put a band together, put the musicians together, had a musicologist come, sped John Legend up.
Me, I tell him, Mr. Rockefeller, raise your glasses to the sky.
Like, you know, did wild shit where I would have tapped out. And he flipped it to make it work. And a lot of people always said that was their favorite record off the College Dropout.
Yeah. Just the idea that he would bring in a musicologist just to be sure that it was far away enough from the source material.
I was there. They would play and they look at the musicologist and he would go, okay, let's try sharp. You know, and then they try another thing four or five times. They looked at him and he finally nodded, yes, I'm going to get out of here. You guys are good to keep going.
Amazing.
So yeah, Porus actually got his credit. It does say additional production. Of course, I made sure that happened. Yes.
You obviously have a new solo album, Whether or Not.
Yeah.
You've said it's the last one in this trilogy of...
One's an EP.
Right.
So yeah,
right,
Cats and... Yeah, so Weatherman, Layover, Cats and Dogs, yeah. Whether or Not.
Are you done with weather metaphors now?
I think so. I'm not going to be shy if one sneaks into it, but I'm not going to just base my projects around this imagery. Mm-hmm. I want to move on to something else and... It's just to scare myself a little bit. This feels like something I got good at.
What is it about particularly on this album, the idea of walking in the rain recurs and recurs?
My reply was, there's more on the way. When I said it, I was walking in the rain.
walking in the rain off the gym beam. Dreams broken on the boulevard, Jim Dean.
Get a grip for it came from a James Dean poster I saw. This Boulevard of Broken Dreams photo. People got it fucked up like I'm a James Dean fan or something. I don't know anything about him, but I just know that there's an image that some photographer took with him walking through Times Square or something with a trench coat, smoking a cigarette, going through a puddle. It just spoke to me. I was like, let me get a trench coat. Let's try to like capture the vibe of this photo. And yeah.
But you've said the idea of rain ties into you being from California and people having it fucked up, that like it's always nice.
Yeah. So I wanted to create like a superhero for myself or something. You know, me and Alchem was talking about it when I started. We were saying, I said, I want to call it the weather, man. He said, that's a good idea. I said, why? He said, because anything man works. Red man, yellow man, method man, you know, you could just keep going on right. and on. Every man, beanie right. man. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't stop. You know, every man works. He was like, so that's a win. And then I figured, so like being from Venice Beach, where it's gloomy mostly because it's a marine layer over us. I'm not a gangster. You know, these are all sunshine, palm trees, gangster rap. I mean, the fashion changed, but I wasn't the Dicky Cortez type either. You know what I mean? So just felt like I'm representing the unsung side of Los Angeles. It's gloomy. I am not a gangster rapper. Might sound like New York more. It's the weather, man. He's here to fucking fly in with his umbrella.
Speaking of weather-related songs, Chase the Clouds Away has always been a favorite of mine. And I think one of the reasons I like it is, although it's a song about being happy, it has the it's a good day trick of the implied contrast, right? You're happy now, but the song implies you're not usually happy. This is an exception.
Completely intended, so much that I even quote, it's a good day. Yo, Alchemist, turn. I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. That's how the good day ends also. Yo, Pooh, turn this shit off, man. I don't know what the fuck I was thinking.
Hey, wait a minute, Alchemist. Stop this shit. I don't know what the fuck I was thinking about. Hey, wait a minute, Pooh. Stop this shit. What the fuck I'm thinking about?
So, yeah, I was really going there with that, trying to do my version of It's a Good Day. And then I remember we were working on the song. Alchemist was helping me with the hook, you know, because I wrote the verses all separately out and the hooks were blank. He was like, maybe you should do something. He's like, I'm not into rapping around the sample, but he's like, this is a good one. My people make me. My music makes me. He said that. And I was like, oh, that's it. But then there was a problem where it was like, this is just a big fucking happy song. So then I went in the booth and I said, cause I ain't always.
My people make me. My music makes me. Cause I ain't always. I must chase the dark clouds away.
He said, as soon as I said that, he's like, we got it. Cause I ain't always. It was like the turn that was what made that song. Those are the most important words in the whole song. Yeah. And then keep in mind, that song is part two. The first song is Dark Clouds, Swollen Members, Black Magic. Out. Dark clouds are hanging all around me. You know, then I did my verse. That was a really special song to me. Still really special. So this was, I must have chased the dark clouds away.
Do you have any other little connections like that, part one, part two, that aren't actually literally labeled part one and part two in your mind?
That's probably the one that really comes to mind. I'd have to think about it.
You've talked a lot about gentrification in parts of LA that you know that you grew up with.
I addressed it on the new album.
Yeah. What actually stood out to me was in Born in LA, you connect that and your mom's death.
It was the beginning. Like that was an early indicator of what was to come 10 years later. It's so crazy. Oh, connected my mom's death. How?
It seems like that it's in what the things you talk about in the song, right?
Yeah.
Her passing and your city changing all are mixed up.
Had me wondering if this is a place I belong.
Some moved locations, some just moved on. The neighborhood changed, the new faces came along. Had me asking myself if this a place I belong. My hustle is strong.
I have to go through my verse. But yeah, I remember that feeling.
Yeah.
It was a trip, man. Like I said, my art meets crime. It was like the bumper stickers in Venice for a long time. You know, you had really active gangs. V13 and Venice Shoreline Crips. And they weren't always peace with each other also. You know, you got to keep that in mind. I grew up in such a Crip-dominated neighborhood that I didn't ever really even see a blood till I was like 15 or 16. And QD3 moved to Crenshaw and MLK, moved to studio there. That was the first time I ever like saw a blood. So and now I'd be pressed to find a gangster on the street. You know, Rico, fucking gang injunctions, all this bullshit they throw at you. Two or more dudes walk in, they consider suspicious. They have the right to suspend your constitutional rights and search you. And it just made it a hard place for a gangster to exist, you know? And then a lot of people got locked up. And the other thing they never talk about is like earthquake thing. You know, in California, when we get an earthquake, a lot of the houses are now considered, they need to be retrofitted. And retrofitting takes a fuck ton of money. So this is how they get people out. They offer you a few hundred grand to fuck out of here. Otherwise, you're going to have to retrofit it. When you retrofit it, your property tax is going to be reassessed. Now you can't pay that. You know, I mean, this is a real trick they got going. So I'd be wondering if earthquakes are man-made sometimes. Like, real shit.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, yo, it's just crazy, man. But yeah, Venice is just not the place I grew up. The interesting part about it is you can't erase Venice and they'll never be able to. So you got people paying $5 million for a house and you still got V13 tagged on their garage when they wake up. You know what I mean? It's just, right. It's not going to go
still,
away.
Still the weirdos, still the kids.
Word up.
Yeah.
But it is different though.
Right.
And so as a homeowner, I like that. Sure. As a father, I like that. Then half of me is like, man, my kid's not going to quite. Venice, maybe one or two other places in Los Angeles are really the only culturally diverse places. Everything else is really racially separate. So to grow up in Venice, I could see why my parents moved from Coney Island and found Venice. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about that. That obviously seems, you know, connected in the ocean. And
yeah, made perfect sense. Ghetto at the beach on both sides.
Yeah, and so that's what I need on the new album is the one that really delves into changes in Venice.
You know, talking about they see me roaming the back streets. My neighborhood became a place for actors and athletes. Used to be where art met crime. Now it's where the rich keep apartments and stay part-time. You know, I ain't tripping, but another misfortune in the ghetto. Lost touch with my homies and the feeling never sent.
People talk about they seen them roaming the back streets. My neighborhood became a place for actors and athletes. Used to be where art met crime. Now it's where the rich keep apartments and stay part-time. I ain't tripping, but another misfortune of the ghetto. Lost touch with my homies and the feeling never settled. The rose is still a rose with no petals. No limits, some no, there's no levels.
I grew up on Rose Avenue. You know, a rose is still a rose with no petals. You know what I mean? Some no limits. So yeah, it was really personal to me. You know what I mean? So
Powder Cocaine is a song that I love on the new record. Can you say where the music come from, where the melody come
yes,
from?
Yes, that was an Alchemist, big Alchemist thing. He said, just I made a beat. It reminds me of Beach Boys or Beatles or something like that. This is where you should go. And he was like, I hear you doing a style where you kind of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He was kind of like patterning out for me almost. Like, that's interesting. Remind me like Lupe Fiasco or something. The way he was. So I tried to powder cocaine. That's a hell of a drug. That's a hell of a saying. They need elephant trunks to get it off of the plate.
I'll be fine like powder cocaine. And that's a hell of a drug. And that's a hell of a saying. They need elephant trunks to get it off of the plate. I want to better myself.
I'm like almost rhyming the way I saw his hands moving when he told me to do it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And before the lyrics happened, I brought my friend Katero over. I wasn't smoking weed at this time. I had a few months sober. I just wanted to refresh. And so I was doing night sessions. I wasn't falling asleep very easy. And he came over one night and I said, I got this thing. Can you try to sound as white as possible? He's like, I'll try. You know what I mean? So he went, voices inside of my mind. Like he was trying, you know, he's not a white guy. You know what I mean? So, yeah. And then the last thing he said, something to me, I'll be fine like powder cocaine. And I was like, what is that? You know? And he's like, I'm just saying I'll be fine like powder cocaine. Like I'll be fine like frog hair or I'll be, that's about the finest thing I could think of. You know what I'm saying? Powder cocaine, thinnest, the finest. I was like, this is dope because I've never done cocaine. And so I'm from Los Angeles. I'm like the unicorn.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Me, the only person in your
Alchemist, your me and Scott Kahn, we made a pact and none of us broke it. So like, wow. We're like the mighty trilogy. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, this is a good time for me to flip it. Once again, this is a down in New York City to me again. This is, people are going to think this is a cocaine song, but I'm going to really talk down. They need elephant trunks to get it off of the plate. I want to better myself. They want to dwell in the pain. I want to better my health. No umbrella for rain. So I would, it's an anti-coke song, really, you know, but cocaine is just powerful in song titles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And By My Side too, obviously very personal song about how your son inadvertently saved his mother's life.
Yeah.
His mother was trying to breastfeed him and she found something when he was trying to do that. It turns out she had stage 3C cancer. And he saved her life, man. He really did.
That happens, or the events, you know, described in the song sort of happen. At what point are you like, do you realize I have to write about this?
you got to understand, this is a girl. We're not, people say my wife, and I don't correct them because she's wifey regardless, you know, but we're not married, you know, and mm-hmm. this is a girl I've been with for a long time. I admire, you're a beautiful woman. And we were having problems towards the end, kind of on the teetering, you know. And a while ago, before that happened, she had stopped taking birth control. So I knew this was always a possibility that could happen. But whatever. And, you know, we were kind of on the out a little bit. And then, you know, we hung out for a little while and it happened. She got pregnant. So just that alone was the beginning. That's so crazy to me because, you know, and I, this is a topic where it's like, I still love you on the Weatherman, where I'm a little reluctant to like delve into it all the way. Not because I'm afraid to share, because this just can never be a selling point. You know what I mean? And so right. I'm reluctant to retweet it. I'm reluctant to do things like that. I didn't make it for those reasons. So, when I talk about it, it's a choice that I'm choosing to let people into my life, because I feel like closing out for 2 years and not sharing was hurting me more than it is to share. So with that said, the fact it was pretty advanced, you know, and they didn't find it in mammograms. They didn't find it in things because it hadn't formed a mass yet, you know, but it was in her for a long time. So the fact that we were on the out, we have this child who lands on Christmas Eve. I mean, and then, you know, he finds her, what was in the cancer that was in her breast, you know, and he finds it. And then I'm not religious, but this is like the closest thing that's going, what are these signs for then? Why? You know what I mean? Why did it all line up like this? Like me having it with her and him coming, like saving her life, you know, but the problem I'm having with this song right now, a major problem, is I wrote it while she was in remission, you know, and now we're going through it again. So it's,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it's, supposed to be a celebration, but now it's turning into more prayers, you know what I mean? So so it's what I'm going through. But she really wanted me to share it with the people. She was really adamant about it. And so I wouldn't take it back for anything. We're just still going through it right now. Yeah.
There are a few songs, I think, that and you know, the one about your mother, and I think maybe one other, that you've said you didn't listen to even during the mixing process. You recorded
just
it,
these,
it to
just
Eddie.
Just these two.
Just those two.
Yeah, I Still Love You and this one. I Still Love You was the one I was talking about.
First Mother's Day without you, woke up feeling doubtful. A lot of hate and pain's been the outcome. It ain't been a year, wounds open, far from healed. Starting to feel scars from scabs peeled.
It's the worst. That, this one I listened to a little bit more, but I had to make a few corrections on this one. But the other one, no, I, you know, like, because he's on the East Coast, when I'm done tracking, I send him a session. And then he sends it back always with, take a listen. That's what it always says, take a listen. And it's mix one, you know, and then I go through it and I dissect it at 40 seconds change, at there's levels, go through it, fine tooth comb. And then we usually, what the world hears is usually mix four, mix five. So this one, what I was trying to say is he sent me mix one, take a listen, and I just wrote back approved. I never even listened to it one time because it was like, so what if the kick is not right or the, yeah, it's not that party. It was just, I need to say this. So yeah.
Have you performed that song? Do you perform it?
I did one time and it made me mad because I did Weatherman in its entirety one time. And by the 16th song, you know, because it wasn't like I did it in order. Bar. By the time I got to the 16th song, people were drunk and I was trying to perform that song and they just weren't quite giving me the attention I needed, so it pissed me off.
On a lighter note,
change
the tune for a minute. In Sleep Deprivation, one of the bonus cuts.
Oh shit.
You talk about Christine giving you nightmares.
Yeah. Scared to drive, I was haunted by Christine from sleepless nights when I dream at 15.
What do you think it was about that story, about the idea of like the haunted car?
Carrie,
that got to you?
Carrie, Christine, all those eras.
All the Stephen King shit?
Yeah, yeah, it fucked me up. I was just young and vulnerable. Yeah, for sure.
I think we have all gone through that at some point, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
One or two final things, like in 10,000 Hours, there's a line in there that I heard is almost kind of cynical about the rappers imitating. You say everyone's imitating Drake except like the real spitters who are just imitating Cool G Rap.
Spitters copy G Rap, the rest are on some Drake shit. Right. I took my time to find my own shit, 10,000 hours. No ball type of loan shit, cause I'm my own it. Burning
bridges. No, that's not what I said. So maybe you took it wrong. I said everyone's an imitation. Spitters copy G Rap, the rest are on some Drake shit. Mm-hmm. I was saying, so there's two forms of rap to me right now. There's a lot of my friends who are all like killers. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the new shit.
Right.
And so like the Spitters, the Killers, you know, they're all sons of Kool G Rap. you even ask them, they'll tell you that. It's not even a mystery. Nas is a son of Kool G Rap. I mean,
yeah.
So you really only, there's only two things. I was saying nothing's really all the subtitle in Italian says nothing new under the sun. You know what I mean? It's yeah. one or the other. And then I said, I took my time to find my own shit. 10,000 hours, no borrow type of loan shit. Cause I'm going to own it. Who sounds like me? I'm asking you. It's hard to pinpoint. I'm influenced by Guru. Maybe you could say the smoothness of Guru, maybe. But if I didn't tell you that, maybe not.
Right. I don't know if I'd have picked up on that as a huge influence if you didn't.
So yeah. I'm proud of like originality is super important to me. So yeah, you could be dope as fuck, but you still just copying Kool G fucking rap. You know what I'm saying? And you over here are dope as fuck, but you just biting some Drake shit.
Yeah.
So I took my time to find my own shit, for better or for worse. It's just, I'm proud of that.
So you've had some friends, and you know, obviously, like we were talking at the beginning, you grew up around the sons and daughters of famous people, and you've had friends from your milieu. I'm thinking of people like Will.i.am, Al Black, who
yeah.
have started in similar spaces, underground spaces, as where you started out, and went pop, whether it was by design yeah. or
a lot of
you know, by accident or whatever. What is it like to see someone like that, you know, Will.i.am all of a sudden be on CNN as a hologram?
Will.i.am, who is live in Grand Park. Let's see if we can beam him in now. Here we go. Will, thanks very much for being with us. How is this night for you?
Oh, this is great. You know
like be a pop culture figure.
Gives you a lot of hope. It does. At a young age, it makes you go, oh, I can do this, you know? Probably when you're young, it's probably tied in with jealousy and it's probably tied in with competition and everything else. But in the bottom of your heart, it is telling you, if he do it, maybe I could do it too. It's inspiring, man. Super inspiring to see your friends blow up. It really is. It comes with a little thing sometimes, you know, a little jolt of whatever feeling you might trigger. But the undertone of all of that is a lot of happiness and optimism, hope for yourself.
Did you see either of those guys, just to take them as examples, do anything different to cross over in your estimation?
A lot of people made smart ass moves. Aloe Black stopped rapping and started singing.
We arrange and balance double sided for less weight. And those that seek equilibrium in the mind state lose their minds and begin to be treated like ingrates.
Wake me up when it's all over. When I'm wiser and I'm older.
There's your first one. Will.i.am got Fergie in the group.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they make calculated moves to make these moves. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? Moves that I probably wouldn't be willing to make.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Is he seeing people do that and knowing that that kind of thing is possible and your peers are doing it? I mean, you're not against having singing, at least on your solo records, maybe not on Dilated stuff so much.
No, we did too. But yeah, no. Well, the thing is, I love singing. So I'm not a singer, but I want to incorporate that. But I want to put it over a beat that wouldn't necessarily call for it, right? So yeah. That's the beauty of the singing on my projects is putting Aloe Black over a hard ass fucking Alchemist beat. You know what I mean? I don't go with the tide ever. I always about the contrast. So that's the beginning. But say the question again because I have a great answer.
Do you think that you could go pop in the same way those guys did?
I think we liked Gangsta. I think we like Special Ed. I think we like DOC. I think we liked a lot of things that said be big, but be you.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe if my genuine interest was something else, I might be bigger artist, but I'm a product of what I love. So here I am. You know what I mean? And I'll take that for the better or for worse, because the part we're all leaving out of this is that every morning I wake up and I get a coffee and I get my little weed and I sit down to a drum machine and I go through records. And that is ultra fulfilling to me. And if I can make something good enough that it makes me want to pick my pen up, then I'm like, wow, I'm really moving. So this is part of my well-being. You know what I mean? Beyond anything else, this is really what I've grown to love doing. And the sound that I love doing is what I believe in. So I think you're going to hear evolution and growth, but it's going to be more of a Gangstar format, updating formulas. Verse changing, you know, and I'm proud of what I represent because I am different, you know, and sometimes it's a little frustrating because it being different might not have give you a place in the industry, or it might not land you a space on the radio, or it might not make you recognizable by a lot of casual fans. But what it does do is supports your family and it allows you to make a living doing something you love and a respectable living at that and get back, you know? And so, and it's not because I'm scared. This is what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Method Man. He had one fucking eye in the video and he had the beanie on and he was this fucking got toothbrush in his mouth. And you know, he was just like this dude, man. And I just loved how he was like so anti. It made me a gigantic Method Man. Then we went to the Source Awards a couple years later as Dilated Peoples. And in the line going in, we were standing in front of Method Man and Redman. They were going in behind us. And I would never forget it. Method Man had on like really expensive glasses, right? Like yellow tinted ones. And he had like a real nice outfit and on. And I just went, my mind went, you don't have to do that. You can come in here with one eye and be the guy. Why are you doing this, man? I was young and stupid and didn't pay rent yet and didn't have any assessment of life. But I was young and my vision was clear and it was right. You can be the grimy guy. There is a place for this always, you know, and no shots of Method Man, fucking one of my greatest heroes. And this was something stupid I observed. But it did tell me, like, when you're young and you see things clearly, you know what the hell you're thinking, you know? And it's like, I try to listen to those adolescent voices still, because it's like, those are the things that drove me to get here. And so, yeah, I never went shiny. I always kept it to try to be the one-eye Method Man in my mind. You know what I mean? It was like, I'm going to stay grimy in who I am. I heard the story, We Are the World, you know, they recorded in this song. Mm-hmm. At A&M Records, the biggest song, every biggest star in the world, and they're all pulling into the gate in their limos or whatever. And the fucking Bruce Springsteen comes running across the street because he fucking parked on the street and put money in the meter. You know what I mean? And the whole session, you know, I heard in between, it could be a lie, could be truth, but in between takes, they're like, yo, Bruce, you might want to go put some money in the meter. You know, but he's the biggest guy in the room, you know? And so to me, I love that. I love the people's chant. I don't want to have the good Cassell glasses on.
What's next? Say, you know, you found a style, you have the weather concept that's sort of run its course. What's next?
A question mark, which is scary and exciting. Really want to try to produce my own solo album. Be a big accomplishment for me because I produced a Mad Child album this year. I produced Farah album this year. I have a whole Crondon album finished. I produced the Damo Genesis EP for My Future. I have an instrumental album, Squirrel Tape Instrumentals, ready to go. I've been landing some, knock on wood, some sort, that some of these tracks I've been landing, some bigger artists might make their record this year. And be full circle if I could rap on my own album and do the production and create a sound the same way that Havoc created the Mobb Deep second album sound, or Premier created the Hard to Earn sound. I want to land on a sound that's mine. And I've been saying it. I want to be like RZA. I want to be like Kanye. I want to be like LP. I want to be known to be ill, whatever. He could make a beat, he could rap, he could jump on stage, he could do some graffiti. You know what I mean? I just want to be, yeah, a double or a triple threat. Yeah.
One final thing that I was wondering about, as someone who is known for crowd diving.
I cut that out.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you ever feel like that was just expected? That it just start to feel like a burden at a certain point?
It was more like dilated driven. Time. Solo stuff is not driven so much by that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not trying to want the hands up in the air, but I'm not looking for the rock and roll energy.
Awesome. Well, Evidence, thank you so much.
Man, this has been long time coming and very awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Peace.
As Evidence mentioned at the end of the show, a talk with him was long overdue. I first remember seeing Dilated Peoples perform in 2002 during the tour to support the documentary Scratch, a movie in which DJ Babu played a major role. It was awesome to be able to hear not only about that era, but also to take it all the way back to QD3's house and the 1990s LA scene that would birth so much talent. One other thing I really enjoyed in this talk was exploring Ev's unique style and hearing the pride he took in developing it. It's a reminder that it's one thing to be good and a whole different thing entirely to have your own ideas and aesthetic. Join us in 2 weeks when we talk to the one and only Eric Sermon. The Green Eyed Bandit is in the midst of making a new album, which he's funding via Kickstarter. We'll talk about that and pretty much every other part of his legendary career. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you check out our archives when you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with Evidence's Rhymesayers compatriot Slug on episode 178. By the way, if you use Apple's podcast to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it.
And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you each episode takes at least 20 hours of work, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, I could afford to track down QD3 and find those early Hooligans demos. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try every month to share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. We've had behind-the-scenes production stories, unreleased Wu-Tang, and all sorts of things you can never find anywhere else, even on our regular episodes. Join us by the end of February to have access to March's file. And again, go buy a shirt, a mug, or whatever you want at merch.thecyphershow.com. You can find us at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
We started smoking weed together, buying weed together. He was selling baseball cards.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You know, driving a Jeep Cherokee and he's always got a hot chick in the front.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He had Cubase.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I was just doing a lot of overcompensating for not being comfortable with who I was.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
Just everyone kind of knows how to do that.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jackson Whelan.
He was also really broke.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
You don't know what time you hit, do you?
About 10.
Oh, shit. Okay. That's perfect.